But we're going to read together this morning from the book of Acts, the Acts of the Apostles, which is the fifth book of the New Testament. We're reading from chapter 14, which you'll find around page 167 towards the very end of the Bible that you have in front of you. Acts chapter 14, and we're going to read from verse 8. Now what's happening here is we're breaking into a story of Paul and Barnabas's missionary journey. Paul and Barnabas, two early church leaders. Paul, perhaps the most famous of all the early church leaders. And they had just, at the beginning of chapter 13, begun to travel, not simply to see the world, but to spread the gospel. It was the first time ever that Christian missionaries had been sent out with the deliberate purpose of going to new places to start new churches and bring people to faith for the first time. And it's a fascinating journey around parts of the Middle East, parts of the northeastern Mediterranean. They began in what's now Syria and traveled to Cyprus and then up into modern-day Turkey, which is where we find them today, and then ended up by going back to where they started from. And what's of real interest to us is not so much the places that they went, except perhaps for students of geography or history, but the things that Paul said and the reaction to their Christian message. We get a flavor of the message in Acts chapter 13, where Paul's first sermon is recorded, and he really talks about how Jesus Christ came to Jerusalem, was crucified by the people there because they didn't recognize him as God's son, even though the Old Testament prophets had described him quite clearly. But God raised him to life and showed that he was the one through whom sins could be forgiven, by whom we could be set free from everything that's wrong with us or holds us back in life. That was the message, and Paul took it to these four or five different locations around that part of the world. And people reacted to him very much in the way that people react today. Some became believers, some asked questions, some ignored him, and some persecuted him. And Paul and Barnabas were chased from town to town. And today we're going to focus on the reaction in the town of Lystra in Acts chapter 14 at verse 8. Lystra was a relatively small town off the beaten track. Paul and Barnabas had been in trouble with the authorities because of their preaching and were perhaps lying low, but nevertheless they couldn't stop themselves from sharing what they believed, and this was what happened. And this is the word of God. In Lystra, there was a man who had been lame from birth and had never been able to walk. He sat there and listened to Paul's words. Paul saw that he believed and could be healed, so he looked straight at him and said in a loud voice, "Stand up straight on your feet." And the man jumped up and started walking around. And when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they started shouting in their own Lycaonian language, "The gods have become like men and have come down to us." And they gave Barnabas the name Zeus and Paul the name Hermes because he was the chief speaker. And in their faith tradition, Hermes was the messenger of the gods. And the priest of the god Zeus, whose temple stood just outside the town, brought bulls and flowers to the gate, for he and the crowd wanted to offer sacrifice to the apostles. And when Barnabas and Paul heard what they were about to do, they maybe didn't speak the local Lycaonian language, so it took a bit of time to work out what was going on, but when they heard what they were about to do, they tore their clothes and ran into the middle of the crowd shouting, "Why are you doing this? We ourselves are only human beings like you. We are here to announce the good news and to turn you away from these worthless things to the living God who made heaven, earth, sea, and all that is in them. In the past, he allowed people to go their own way, but he's always given evidence of his existence by the good things he does. He gives you rain from heaven and crops at the right times. He gives you food and fills your hearts with happiness. And even with these words, the apostles could hardly keep the crowd from offering a sacrifice to them. Just stop there and thank God for his word, which we are able to read and to understand. Why do you think I am a Church of Scotland Christian? What is it that has made me who I am today? Well, as a matter of fact, I was brought up in a Church of Scotland home. My parents were both elders in the church. My mother taught Sunday school. My father was the treasurer. It was to their church that I went as a child, and that's where I heard about God. And so when I began to ask my own questions, to say my own prayers, to express my own faith, it was perhaps only natural that I did that in the words and the traditions, the forms of worship, and the kind of language to which I was used, just as the language I speak, to some extent the way I dress, my taste in food and music, even the international rugby team I have the misfortune to support. I am half Irish, so it's not all bad. But all of these things just reflect how I have been raised. And so, if it had not been for that geographical accident which saw me born into and brought up in the south side of Glasgow, I might instead have been a Russian Orthodox Christian, or a Southern Baptist, or an African Pentecostal, able to both sing and clap at the same time. Can you imagine? Or even perhaps a Tibetan Buddhist, an Iranian Muslim, or an Orthodox Jew. People look to God because life is mysterious and demands an explanation. There must be something out there. And people respond to God because they have some sense of his presence or some kind of experience which demands a reaction. And even though God is in heaven, whatever that is, because we are natives of the planet Earth, our response to him is always going to be couched, not in the language and behavior of heaven, which we don't know, but according to the way that we live and in terms of what we are familiar with. So we see in our story we just read, the natives of Lystra, I've been calling them Lycra all week, which is stretching things a bit. That wasn't bad. I just made that up. It's not even written down here. The natives of Lystra, when they saw a miraculous healing, something which they couldn't explain, they responded in terms of the worship with which they were familiar. They thought of Zeus. They thought of Hermes. Their own priest came out from their own temple and they offered the kind of sacrifice that they were used to. And in just the same way, if I was not going to grow up as an atheist, then it was always likely that I would be a Church of Scotland Christian. And there's a lot of truth in that. The growth of Christianity from the few dozen believers who were there with Jesus at the end of his life on earth to the few thousand that are there a generation later at the end of the book of Acts, which we are reading now, to the multi-million, multinational, multicultural phenomenon that is Christianity today, that growth is made possible because the gospel message is capable not only of translation into the language of each people group that it comes across, but also capable of being expressed, or the response to it expressed, in every culture and in every human heart. We might think, if we are familiar with the church at all, we might think of it as traditional. And you might think of that as a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your perspective. But we are familiar with traditional church buildings, steeples and big blocks of sandstone, perhaps with ministers in robes, with the authorized version of the Bible translated into English 400 years ago, with hymns by Charles Wesley and Isaac Watts. And these things always seem to have been there, a kind of frozen in time phenomenon. But the fact remains that even these things simply reflect styles of music and figures of speech that would have been utterly foreign to the first century Middle Eastern first Christian generation. They were just familiar to people here in the Western world at the time when Christianity was perhaps strongest in our society. And now that times are changing and we are more or less happily leaving some of these traditions behind because the faith which we believe is capable of being expressed in ways which are natural to us now. But is that all there is to it? Is there more to faith than simply saying it's some kind of human response to some sense of the presence of God, and beyond that, it doesn't matter how you do it? Is all that matters that we grab hold of something that we can believe which helps us in times of distress, or something that disciplines us in times of temptation? And beyond that, is it simply the case that our form of our faith is as much a matter of personal choice as our taste in breakfast cereal, or as much a matter of where we were brought up as the team we support? What I want you to notice is that our Bible story this morning about Lystra and these remarkable goings-on is not about people coming to faith. It's not about atheists deciding that there is a God after all, or agnostics making up their minds after a period of uncertainty. It's about people converting from one faith to another. Paul himself, who was preaching the message here, was a convert to Christianity, having been brought up as an Orthodox Jew, and he lived out that Jewish faith with youthful passion. You can read about it earlier on in the book of Acts. And he grew up as a Roman citizen in a world which was a real marketplace of different cults and philosophies. There was a huge choice of things that he could have believed. And as an educated man, he probably knew about most of them. And out of that, he chose Christianity. Paul would say Christianity, or Jesus Christ, chose him. But he plumped for one option instead of all the others. And here he is preaching that gospel of Jesus Christ to a town that already has a priest, already has a temple place of worship, already has an established pattern of sacrifice. And his clear message to those people, as one who had himself been changed, is that they must change too. And he sums it up in verse 15. If you look back to what we read together, his message to them is to turn away from these worthless things to the living God. Why am I a Christian and not a Muslim, a Hindu, an Orthodox Jew? Could it be that the gospel contains a little bit more than human conjecture? A little bit more than some kind of generic response to God wrapped up in the particular culture of the time? But the actual self-revelation of the living God as his words and not mine. Look at the healing miracle with which our story begins this morning. It was a truly remarkable event. We are told the man who was healed had been lame from birth, presumably known locally as such. He wasn't a stooge planted in the audience to trick them. He wasn't just pretending to use a crutch or a wheelchair. He'd been probably begging every day, incapable of doing everything else. And he was made able to walk. It's a miracle that demands an explanation. Nevertheless, if we read the whole story of Acts chapter 14, we would have to wonder, why is this particular miracle given so much airtime? If you look at verse 3, which is just before the part that we read, it tells us there that Barnabas and Paul had been given power to perform a whole variety of miracles and wonders. So why is this single one, the healing of the lame man, singled out for special attention? Well, part of the answer, I think, is that in general, the Bible sees miracles not simply as proof of God's power. It's not just attention-seeking or an advertising gimmick. The form of the miracles, what God does, is always a sign that points towards who God is or what his ambitions are. So in general, a healing miracle is a foretaste of heaven. And it points us towards a God who wants to sort things out and make things better physically, but emotionally, socially, in every other way as well. God wants things to be right for us. And the miracles point us in that direction. And this particular miracle, I think, whoever has written this story first has recognized that it points out or illustrates the whole way in which God is trying to reach us and change us and put things right for us through the gospel. Look at the stages that this miracle takes us through. First of all, in verse 9, the lame man who was sitting there, it tells us, listened to Paul's words. Now, you'll be aware sometimes, maybe you've sat in a class at school or university and been aware that while the lecturer is speaking, some folk are listening and others are not. Sometimes happens on a Sunday morning as well, although obviously not here. But he listened to Paul's words, and we know what Paul spoke about. He spoke about the death and resurrection of Jesus, the death for our sins so that we could be forgiven, the resurrection for our life so that we could be set free. That was his consistent gospel message. So the man, first of all, listened to God's words, or Paul's words. But secondly, Paul saw that the man, the lame man, believed. In spite of the language barrier, because Paul didn't speak the native language, so this was either the man's second language or maybe there was a translator, but also in spite of the fact that this man had probably never heard anything like the gospel message before, nevertheless, the words made sense to him. Have you ever had that experience when it just feels like a light going on when something is explained to you? It falls into place. It just rings true. It wasn't that the man was desperate for healing and therefore ready to believe anything, because there's no indication that Paul was talking about healing while the man was listening and when he believed. He simply heard the same words as the whole of the rest of the crowd that were there that day, but while to many of the others they made no particular difference at all, to him, they were precious. And he knew that they were true. He believed. And then thirdly, in verse 10, Paul issued an instruction, like a military drill sergeant. Stand up straight on your feet, shoulders back, chest out, no slouching. It's a very direct command to do something which for a layman would be impossible. It makes no more sense than someone telling me to jump up and touch the ceiling. I can't do it. And it would have been a cruel jest to go around making fun of lame men by telling them to walk if the words hadn't had the power which, in fact, they did. Because we see that fourth and finally, the lame man jumped up and started walking around. No tentative feeling his way. He didn't lean on somebody's shoulders and stagger up and put a little bit of weight on one ankle. No experimenting, no slight improvement in his condition. He didn't go from being lame to limping. He jumped up and started walking around. So he responds immediately with just as much confidence as that with which the order had been issued. Paul said, "Do it." And the man knew that he could. John Calvin puts it like this. He said, "The lame man was already walking in spirit while his feet were still dead." In other words, he'd heard the gospel. His heart and soul had been moved by what he heard. And his body was playing catch up. That's the way the miracle story is told. And I think what Luke, he's the author of the book of Acts, I think what Luke is doing is presenting us here with a straight choice between two responses to the gospel message. Not a choice between faith and unbelief. Do I think that God exists or not? But a choice between two possible responses for those who now recognize there is something going on here that they have to do something about. What are they going to do? And the choice is either to be like the lame man, who I think Luke is saying this is an illustration of the way it ought to be, who heard God's word as a word of command which he instantly obeyed, or else to be like the rest of the crowd who realized that something had happened and did their own thing about it. So where the lame man obeyed, the crowd conformed to the kind of thing they'd always done. They used their own God's names. They stuck to their own traditions. They repeated their normal sacrifice. Now, you might have expected Paul and Barnabas to be encouraged. The whole town was on side. They'd got their attention. They'd made a really good impression and clearly produced a heartfelt response from a stunned congregation. Some of us who've preached long and hard and received almost no reaction at all except the occasional yawn would just love to have folks running about and doing something in the way that Paul and Barnabas produce a response here. Okay, there might still be some explanation needed, some Bible teaching to move them on from Hermes and Zeus to the living God, some contact with other Christians so that they could fall into the established pattern of how the church should work. But God has acted and people have reacted. Surely that's a fantastic start. But quite clearly, Paul and Barnabas were horrified. They ripped their clothes in verse 14, which was a sign of grief, a sign of distress. And they ran about into the midst of this responsive crowd, trying to stop them from doing what they were planning to do, because they were shocked and disgusted and deeply disappointed. So if God was to act in your life today and make his presence clearly felt, maybe a miracle cure because these things happened, or maybe an answer to a desperate prayer because these things happen, or maybe an unexpected blessing because these things happen as well, I wonder if you would be in danger of repeating the crowd's mistake of understanding God only in the light of your experience and limiting him to that. See, the Greek gods, Zeus and Hermes, if you read the old stories of Greek mythology, you know, those gods were amazing. They could do incredible things and had tremendous powers and had amazing adventures as well. But they were terribly, terribly limited morally, emotionally, in power, certainly in love, compared with the God who's revealed in the Bible. Very especially in terms of their commitment to human beings, the Greek gods were basically selfish and power hungry. They fought with each other and used human beings as pawns, or they exploited or blackmailed or sought primarily their own advantage or had favorites, which means that others were despised. They had to be bribed or appeased. And Paul and Barnabas didn't want their God's reputation to have anything to do with that. And that's why they were shocked and horrified. To what would we be in danger of reducing God today if we thought of him merely in terms of our own limited experience, in order to contain him, perhaps, or in order to understand him, or in order to be at peace with him? What image of ourselves would we project onto God? Because it's something at which our world is well practiced. There's not that many people around who would completely deny any possibility of evidence for the existence of God. And very many people would talk about some personal spiritual experience. And yet, we tend to live our business lives, develop our careers. We tend to live our social lives, our family lives, our sex lives, as if God wasn't there. Just as in Lystra, they had a box with Zeus and Hermes marked in the lid, and they fitted God into that. So we tend to do the same thing today, and we need to challenge ourselves by asking, what is written on the lid of the box into which we try to squeeze God, to confine him to our own expectations? Is it a box that says, good for the children? Maybe you've told your children Bible stories. Maybe you pray with them at bedtime. But is the living God involved in your life? Or is it a box that says, for emergency use only? Maybe you've turned to God in times of deep distress, very often in bereavement or in sickness. People find a remarkable faith, and it's comforting to know that God is there, and then they go back to living the rest of their lives as if he wasn't. Or is it a box that's wrapped up in Christmas paper with a tag that says, do not open until 25th December? We love to think of the Son of God becoming a human being and sing with the angels and dress up with the shepherds and live for most of the rest of our lives as if he wasn't there. Or is it that more subtle thing that we are skilled at doing of taking God and putting him into a box marked spiritual? Maybe every day or regularly every week we open that box and we have a spiritual time with God. And all our physical things and all our material things and all our social things are put in different boxes, which are only ever opened when that one has been closed. Now maybe you're thinking, that's all very well. And if I had an experience like the lame man of God speaking clearly and directly to me, of the lights going on, of the words ringing true, of the word of command coming with undeniable authority, then I too would jump at God's request. That would all be very well, but that's never happened to me. I'm still struggling to understand. Well, in one sense, if that's where you are, then I'm afraid I can't help you. Not even a Church of Scotland minister can produce God at his command. And I don't know in this story why it was that he spoke clearly to this one man and apparently not to the rest of the crowd. And I don't know why he hasn't spoken clearly to you, if that is the case. I don't know when he will. Maybe it's now, maybe it will be today. But I can say this, that if you haven't heard him yet, then you can at least avoid the mistake of behaving as if you had. You can avoid the mistake of being decided in the way that your response to God is shaped, when you're really still undecided, and of going on to do what you think God might want when you've never really asked him, or guessing what he might be like when you've never really heard him, or letting other people shape your response and joining the crowd going off to the temple of Zeus or whatever without really looking for him. There isn't any need for that, because Jesus says very clearly in the Bible, he says, ask and you will receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened. And you're surely far, far better standing outside the right door still knocking than going off through the wrong one. And the living God will not miss out while we wait. The living God is not so small that he needs our activity, our worship, or our wisdom, or our temples, or our sacrifice to boost his self-confidence or fill the place where he should be. Paul explains in verse 15 that this is the God who made heaven and earth and sea. So there is nothing in earth that we can give him or do for him that isn't his already. God won't miss out. Paul also explains in verse 17 that that God produces the food that we eat and that results in our happiness and our satisfaction. He is a God who takes care of us. He doesn't demand satisfaction from us. He doesn't take satisfaction away from us. He delivers it to us. And the time has gone, he says in verse 16, when they simply allowed people to go their own way. The time has come with Jesus, when he wants people to come his way, to know him as he really is. Some people have an image of a God in whom they don't believe, a God who is petty, capricious, cruel, angry, or clever and deceptive, taking simple people in. I'm not going to believe in a God like that. I'm too smart. I don't believe that he exists. And other people have their own image, their own projection of a God in whom they do believe, who is easy to get on with, who is comforting to live with, a God who very often agrees with us. That's a worrying sign. A God who is there when you want him and not when you don't. But those who know the living God, this is what the story tells us, those who know the living God know his healing power within. And even those who know they don't know him, at least know that they're waiting, which is a better place to be than halfway through a wasted sacrifice to an unrewarding notion. Because that waiting place remains a place where God might yet be heard, speaking to us through his word.